Maybe it's recording now. Maybe not. I have no idea. I don't care. No, that's not what I wanted. This is, it's completely screwed up now. Whatever. So today will be dedicated to introducing you to this structure-proof language called ESA, and most of the time will be taken up by giving you a number of examples of showing you ESA proofs, and then certain proof patterns, and finally how to streamline the proofs. I won't be going into proofs by induction yet. That will be next week. And so the main drawback of these apply scripts is that they are quite unreadable, and they're also hard to maintain. If you have a longer apply script and you change something, it's really hell. And they just simply don't scale. So the main problem there is there's no structure, and that is why we have these ESA proofs. And so an apply script you can think of as an assembly language program where you just give the commands, but you don't see what the proof state is after those commands. And then an ESA proof is more like a structured program with nested blocks, but also with assertions that tell you at certain points what you are actually trying to prove. So they don't rely on your implicitly following the commands, but they, in those proofs, in those ESA proofs, you have to explicitly state what you are proving at any given point. And the apply style will still be useful for proof exploration. So this is what a typical ESA proof looks like. This is a block with a proof at the beginning and a QAD at the end. And these blocks typically start with an assume statement where you assume certain hypotheses that are valid in that block. And then you have a sequence of half steps where you prove intermediate formulas by the standard techniques like SIMP and BLAST. And finally, you have a show step where you prove the actual outcome of the block. So the intermediate ones, formula 1 up to formula n, they were just helpful steps to get to the end result, and that is the formula n plus 1. And in the end, such a block will prove the formula that the assumption implies what the show statement has proved, and the rest in the middle is not relevant for the outside, and it's just that implication that is exported. So that's the skeleton of a typical ESA proof, and this is the core syntax from which this skeleton was derived. So what is a proof? In the first line, so this is the grammar for proofs. In the first line, we have a structured proof, a proof block that starts with proof and ends with QED and has a sequence of steps in the middle. So step star is a sequence. And in the beginning, after the proof, you can optionally, that's why it's in square brackets, also state a proof method, how you want to start the proof. A typical thing here would be to say, I want to prove this by induction. So you would say proof and then in parentheses induction on something or other. And the first one, the proof QED, is a lengthy block or potentially lengthy block. If it's just an atomic proof, then you say by method. And method will be one of the proof methods that we have already used. So method could be SIMP, BLAST, induction, whatever you have, all the things that we have already seen. And what is a step? A step can be one of three things. You can either fix a variable. That is typically when you're trying to prove some universally quantified statement, and then you now say, oh, I fix a certain variable, and that stays fixed throughout the proof. Or if you do an induction on n, then you will often fix the variable n at the beginning of the proof. Or, so this here is just in parentheses to say this corresponds to the formula with a big universal quantifier. Similarly, the assume, a proposition, that corresponds to the left-hand side of an arrow. So that means you're proving something where you have additional assumptions. And these typically occur at the very beginning of a proof block, where you say, okay, now fix these variables and assume these properties. And then you have all these steps, and mostly they will be half steps, or at the end it will be a show step. So this is meta notation, what I'm using here. The parentheses are not actual parentheses of the language that I'm describing, but they are grouping parentheses of the grammar. So it means you have a have or a show, and then a proposition that you are proving, and then a proof, which is again one of these objects in the top. So this is really a nested, it can be a nested, arbitrarily deeply nested proof structure. And then what do we have here at the beginning? Here at the beginning we have, again, something optional. You can also say from, and then a sequence of facts, you have something. So that means in your proof you explicitly, or rather in that proof step, you explicitly pipe some facts into your proof that the proof method here at the end can then make use of those facts as it pleases. So a priori, it's not clear how these facts will be processed, but they are offered to the proof method, and the proof method will then choose what to do with it. Typically, those facts that I'm piping into the proof are simply made part of the proof state, and then the method is applied to it. And finally, what is a proposition? It's mostly just a string with a formula inside, and optionally it can have a name, because after all you may need to refer to intermediate results when you go back and look at the skeleton. Then proving these intermediate results will only be helpful if you can actually make use of them later on. And so in reality, these formulas will have names, and then you can refer to those names in further proof steps. So that's why here in the grammar, a proposition isn't just a formula, but it's an optionally named formula. And finally here, when we say from fact, that is, in its simplest case, just again a name. So that's the point where we refer to some previously named fact that can be a lemma that you have proved globally, or it can be a local fact that you've proved a few lines further above with a have, and where you have given it some name here. So where in the have or the show, this proposition has been a named formula. So, any questions about this grammar and how these things fit together before we even see any example? Because you may still be confused by the grammar and by the parentheses or what's not. Well, then let's look at some examples. So now we have to... No, that's not it. That's it. Apparently not. Yeah, this is it. Okay. Let's make this even a little bit bigger. Yep. Oh, actually, I think do we really go over to the slides? I don't think we... I think we continue here, and then we go over to Isabel. I was jumping the gun. So the example I want to show you is Cantor's theorem, and not because Cantor's theorem will be of great relevance to this course, but because it's a particularly nice and simple example that exhibits a lot of the basic features of the language. So what is Cantor's theorem? It says there is no surjective function from a set to its power set. And this is how you can phrase it in ESA. So we're making use of the type system. So we're saying, okay, F here is a function from a type A to a set, so to the power set of A. And then I'm claiming, given such a function with this type, it cannot possibly be surjective. So that's just another way of phrasing that if you have a function, that there is no function from from A to the power set of A that is surjective. And how do we prove this? We start off with a proof, so it's a longer sequence of steps. And what happens now is that if you just say proof without any explicit proof method, remember if you go back to the syntax, proof after the proof, you could put a proof method to tell the system how you want to prove that statement. We are not saying anything, and so then the system will apply a default proof method, and the default proof method will just look at the syntax of what you're trying to prove, and it sees a negation, and it says, ah, by default, a negated formula is proved by assuming the unnegated formula and proving false from it. So you assume that you have a surjective function f, and then you prove false from it. That's what the system will do if you don't instruct it to do anything else. Okay, so that means you are now allowed to assume that surjective of f. Now, you really have to state that. It's not that this happens implicitly. What happens implicitly is that the system says, oh, this is how you want to prove it, but you still, for readability reasons, you still have to state that assumption so that the reader doesn't have to understand the implicitness here. It's the reader just says, okay, you now assume that f is surjective, so you're doing a kind of a proof by contradiction. And we are giving that assumption a name. We call it A because I don't want to think about what to name things. And then from this assumption A, we have a first consequence we call B. And the consequence says that for all A, for all big A, there is a little a such that the big A is just the image, the result of f of a. So this is a direct restatement of what surjectivity means. Surjectivity of a function simply means for everything in the result type, there must be something in the argument type such that that result is the image of that function. So it's nothing but restating surjectivity. And I've chosen big A because typically one uses capital letters for sets. And so that is supposed to remind you, oh yes, I'm talking about something of this range type here, A set. And of course, the little a is of the domain type A. And then I'm claiming that this set is actually the result of applying F to this A. Of course, the fact that A has the type A set and little a has the type A is just a consequence of type inference because we know the type of F, and if you write down this formula, then those types follow. And we can prove this simply by adding the surjectivity definition simplification does it. Now, here we're doing the creative step from B to C. So from B, I claim we now have the following proposition, which is just a special case of the proposition above. The proposition above says something is true for any set A here. And now we have replaced this for all A by a very specific set big A, namely this funny set here, the set of all X, such that X is not an element of f of X. Now, don't worry about it. If you don't understand why we're doing this, it's not important because I'm not teaching you Cantor's theorem. I'm teaching you how to write a structured proof. And so it seems the person who wrote this proof thought it was a good idea to specialize the B statement with that particular set. Whether that leads anywhere, we shall see. So this is, of course, just a complete logical triviality. If you have a universally quantified statement, then it will hold for any specific instance that you may supply for the universally quantified variable big A. So this is just blast. It's just pure logic. And now, you from C, we can show false very easily, except that if you see this for the first time, it may not be completely obvious why the statement C is actually contradictory. We will later on come back to this. At the moment, don't worry about it. BLAST can prove it. And so the actual logical step that went on inside BLAST is not of any relevance to us anymore. We're taking a more global point of view, and we just look at the proof structure. And so BLAST confirmed that from C you could prove false, and that's exactly what you had to do by the default proof step that the system performed up there. You were allowed to assume surjective, and then you had to show false. And so now you can state QED, and the system will accept this, and you're done. Questions about this proof? Not the details, but the structure. Then, let's look at it again in the system. And here is that very same proof. Just for variation, I have chosen to not name the statements A, B, C, but to name them 0, 1, and 2. So you can also use individual digits, but it stops at individual digits. It doesn't support a basic style of programming where you have fact 99 and fact 57. So you have to be a bit, you can't go overboard with the numbers. So that's what we start with. And now I will show you a few ways of making this proof a bit more streamlined so it reads more naturally and you have to type less. The first step is simply, the first step is simply to make the proof a little bit shorter, but it has nothing to do with ESA per se. But it's possible that from zero you can get to one directly. Sorry, to get to two directly, you don't need this intermediate fact. The proof automation is powerful enough to jump directly from subjective F to step two. So I will do that here. And again, the reason is simply because it can be done and the logical details are irrelevant. So that's what we start out now with. This is the proof that we will manipulate further. And the first thing that you noticed both with the previous proof but also still with this proof is that it has a sequential nature in the sense of purely sequential nature. Every proof step refers merely to the previous proof step. So you say from zero have one, from one have something else. One can, with these kinds of proofs that are quite frequent and that are nice because they are quite readable. With these proofs, you can use the following abbreviation. Namely, you can use the word this rather than having to invent a label. This simply refers to the previous thing that you've proved. So this is the next version of the same proof. You can still see at the top the previous proof. And now, instead of inventing these labels and then referring to the previous label, here you just use the this and you say from this, which means from the previous line. Now there's no more need to invent names or labels because the proof is nice enough that it only refers to the previous line. It doesn't refer to lines that are further back, in which case you would need to invent those names. And now things can be taken a bit further, but you don't have to. This is for convenience only. Because the from this also occurs quite frequently in proofs, there is another abbreviation, namely from this can be abbreviated to then. And now the proof reads like this. So this is purely a syntactic abbreviation. Instead of from this, we've written then. And if you want to take it one level further, then you can use the following abbreviations. Then you can write hence for then have and thus for then show. And then you get to this last version of the proof that I wanted to show you. And it's completely up to you, how far you want to take it. I would certainly recommend to minimize the number of names that you have, because if you read a proof and it's a bit longer, and then you have these names that refer to things that are further back, that typically means you have to scroll back and see what did this name stand for. Minimizing names is a good idea. The rest, the then have or something, that's stylistic. Any questions about this? Then let's go back to the slides. Yeah, this just summarizes what I said. This is an alternative. Instead of putting the thing that you are using in your proof, putting the fact that you're using the proof in front of it, so instead of saying from and then some name, you can also put it behind it, and then you can write have or show the proposition, and then using the facts, if the facts are kind of merely auxiliary and you don't want to mention them right at the beginning. So again, this is a stylistic thing. If you want to emphasize what you're proving it from, or if you want to de-emphasize that, if you want to de-emphasize it, you put it afterwards. If you want to emphasize it, you would put it in front. But yeah, it doesn't make any difference. And so this is just a postfix way of writing the from facts. And then there's also with facts, which is short for from facts and this. So you don't have to learn all of those by heart. If you just start with from and have and show, then you'll be okay. And the other things you may learn over time. Now, sometimes it's actually useful to state a lemma, break the statement of a lemma up into its components, namely, the first part, the fixes, is like a declaration of some of the variables in the statement. So rather than putting the type of a function like in the previous version of the proof, if you look at this version of the proof, we had put the type of the function into the statement, and that may be just blowing up the statement, so it may be nicer to write it like this. And in English, you would say, let f be a function from a to a set. This is how you write it in ESA. And then you state your assumptions, one or more of them, and then you show, you state what you want to show. So this is just another way of taking the implication apart, or taking an implication apart. So here, this is an example of an implicational statement. You're trying to prove that surjective of f shows false. So this is not identical to the previous proof. In the previous proof, we really proved a negated fact. Here we prove an assumption, we prove an implication that if you assume surjective of f, then you can deduce false from that. And the one advantage of this statement is that you can now refer to the assumptions by name. So here you would say proof minus. Why proof minus? Minus means don't do anything automatic. Just leave things as they are. No automatic proof step. So you still have your subjectivity assumption. That's part of your statement. And now you can do the same proof as before and prove this, that there exists a little a such that this funny set here is the image of A under F, and now you say using S, so you can refer to your assumption here by name. So if you compare this proof, it then continues as before, with the previous proof, what you see is, in the previous proof, you had two statements that said surjective F. Once was in the actual statement that you proved, there was a sub subformula surjective F, and one was in the assume step. There's again a formula surjective F. So that's a duplication, and if you are allowed to name assumptions, like here in this style, then you don't need to duplicate it. You have this assumption surjective F already, and you can use that name in the proof, and you don't need to restate it. So that's just a convenient way to write down statements that have assumptions and a conclusion. And it proves really the implication of from all the assumptions to the conclusion false. And the proof itself is similar to the earlier one, so I don't want to go through it again, but I just wanted to emphasize the way the structured statements work. And this is really the essence of all these structured proofs, that in contrast to what we've seen so far, where we always had this soup of assumptions from which you had to show some conclusion, and you couldn't refer directly, you couldn't put your hand on any of the assumptions. You just had to hope that the automatic tactics would be able to bridge that step from the assumption to the conclusion. Now you can give name to the assumptions, and you can more fine-grained in some proof steps say, oh, and from this assumption and that one, I now want to conclude something specific. And this explicit reference is important, because if you have too many assumptions, then automatic proof steps may just fail, because they don't know which are the relevant assumptions and which are the irrelevant ones. And if you say so explicitly, then you can help the automation. Yeah, that we don't need to look at. So that was the basic intro to the language. Now, proof patterns. Those are patterns that show particular forms of reasoning, and they correspond to basic rules of logic. And I'm not showing proofs of rules of logic, I'm showing you textual incarnations of those proofs as either proof skeletons. So here is one form of case distinction, and you want to show some proposition R here at the beginning, and then you say, I'm doing a proof by cases. So the proof method that you are explicitly stating is, I'm doing a proof by cases, and then you have two subblocks that are separated by a next. And the first block assumes some proposition P, and again, you have to show R. Of course, you have to give a proof there. And in the next block, you assume not P, and again, you show R. So you show R twice under the two assumptions, one under the assumption P and one under the assumption not P. So this is one form of a proof by case distinction, where the system, I mean, when you say proof by cases, at that point, you don't have to state what the two cases are, the P and the not P. That stays implicit in the text, because the proof by cases method assumes that you will have two subblocks, one of this form and the other one of this form. And you can't change them in the order. So you first have to prove the one with the P and then the one with the not P. So whenever you think, oh, I should be doing a proof by cases, go back to this pattern. There is an alternative proof by cases which works from some fact that you have already shown, and that fact has to be an OR fact. So if you have shown P or Q, then you can do a case distinction from that, and you really have to take this fact and feed it into the next proof. So that's why this then is there. Remember, then stands from this show, from this. So from this OR, we want to show something, and then the proof step here says, oh, the user is piping an OR into this proof, so I'd better do a case distinction on the OR. And now I am allowed to write this subproof, one where we assume P and one where we assume Q, and the two subproofs are separated by the next. And so it's very much like the proof over here, except over here I'm doing a case distinction on P or not P, but I don't have to state that explicitly. Here it's some other or, and I do state it explicitly. I mean, I state and prove it here in the first line, and then I use it to make this case distinction in the next proof block. Proof by contradiction, there are two forms. One form we have already seen, namely, if you want to show a negated statement, one way of doing this and the default way of doing this is you assume the statement P and then you have to show false. And this is one form of the contradiction. Another one is if you have any statement, not just a negated one. So this will assume, this only works if you have a negated statement. If you have an unnegated statement and you want to negate it and assume it, then you have to say so explicitly, and this is how you do it. You use the proof method rule, and you explicitly use the proof rule called C contra, which stands for classical contradiction. So just, you don't have to remember this, you just look up the template from the slides. If you ever get into the situation that you would like to show P by assuming not P and showing false from that. So this is an alternative to this one where you don't have to explicitly say anything. Here the proof is by default, if it looks at the negated statement that you're trying to prove, it says, I'm allowed to assume P and I have to show false. Here, because you wouldn't want this to happen every time you do a show, so this negation of the statement that you're showing, that requires an explicit invocation of the proof rule, classical contradiction. Here's a proof pattern for how to prove an if and only if, an equality between Boolean formulas. If you don't say anything, then by default what will happen is you're allowed to assume P and then show Q, and then in the second block you're allowed to assume Q and show P. So you just show the two implications, and that implicit proof step here combines them and proves the equivalence from the two implications. And finally, for these basic constructs, how do we deal with the quantifiers? And there are four ways how to deal with quantifiers, two of how to prove a formula with a quantifier in it. Those are called the introduction proofs. And how you can prove something from a universally or existentially quantified formula. So first, let's look at how you can show a universally quantified formula. Here, for example, for all x, p of x. How do you do that? Well, you can just say proof, and then the system will just look at the formula and say, oh, it's a universally quantified formula. So what I expect you to do is I expect you to fix some local name for that universally quantified formula, and then you have to show the thing inside without the quantifier. And that, of course, will require another proof. So this proof step simply gets rid of the universal quantifier. You textually make the X part of your context, and then you can zoom in and show the formula underneath the quantifier. And for the existential quantifier, you can also just say, show there exists XP of X, proof. So what are you then allowed to do? You are then allowed to show P of some arbitrary witness, some arbitrary term like 5 plus 5 or the empty list or whatever. And this proof step here, the first one, implicitly says, okay, you're trying to prove an existentially quantified formula. So if you don't say anything else, I assume you will, in this proof block, show me that P is true for some witness term. And these are the two ways of proving an existential or a universally quantified formula. And how to make use of an existentially quantified formula, that requires a new language construct called obtain. And so this is how it looks like. This is a standard template for the obtain. Typically, you have an existentially quantified formula. There exists an XP of X, and now you want to get your hand on the X and do something with it, and get your hand on the P of X. And this is how you do it. You say, then obtain X. So you really pipe this statement into the next proof block. You obtain an X where P of X is true, and you give that fact a name, little p. And that proof from this line to the next line is completely trivial, so you just write biplast, that'll do it. All we are doing here at this point, you say, well, give me a name, or I will give you a name for this existentially quantified formula. I've chosen the X again, but I could have chosen a different name. And then I want to get my hand on the property P of X. And now in the rest of the proof block, I can use the X, which is a fixed local variable, and I can use the little p, which stands for the fact that P of X is true. So in this proof block, you no longer need to deal with this existentially quantified formula, but you have the formula inside the existential. But in order to make this step, you need the obtain. So you ask the system, please give me, in some sense, you can also call this a witness. Please give me some witness. I've shown that there must exist an X now. Therefore, let me give this X a name. Let's call it X again. And then allow me to refer to the inside of the existentially quantified formula with the name P that I can choose arbitrarily. And if you have more than one existential quantifier, there exists X, Y, Z, it works the same way. And now we can actually use this example to clear up a statement that, or a proof step that may have been a bit unclear earlier on. Remember this proof of Cantor's theorem, and from the surjectivity, we jumped to this step that was still understandable, but then there was the claim that this formula is contradictory, and that may no longer be completely obvious. So now let's make that obvious, and let's use the obtain statement. So we know there exists an A with this property here that the what is often called Cantor set, the diagonal set, the set of all X such that X is not an element of F of X, that is equal to the image of A under F. So this is just a purely trivial step. Now we can use this A, and we can use this proposition. And we don't give this proposition a name because we will directly do something with it. We will now ask ourselves, if these two sets are equal, then, of course, the little a that we have just obtained should be an element in one of the sets, if and only if it's an element of the other two sets. If two sets are equal, then if you ask yourself a question, is there an element in one set, then it should be the same if it's in the other set. So that should be a direct consequence. And so what we have here in this if and only if, on the left-hand side, we just have a simplification of the statement that little a is in this set here, because little a is in this set if and only if little a is not an element of f of a. So that's the result of the left side. On the right side, well, we simply ask ourselves the question, is little a in f of a? So that's just the right side. And so from here to here is, again, a purely logical inference that uses a little bit of reasoning about sets, but it doesn't need to know anything about f or a. It's just pure set theory. And now, of course, the contradiction stares us in the face, that a is not an element in f of a if a is an element of f of a. Well, that clearly is contradictory. So thus false by blast should not be surprising. And so this is one use of the obtain, is to really make smaller proof steps from an existentially quantified formula and elucidate the reasoning. To do with sets, here are two further. So that was just an example of the obtain. Now we go back to the proof patterns. If you want to reason about sets, here is a useful proof pattern. If you want to show equality of two sets, you show the subset, that one set is a subset of the other in both directions. So again, this is a fixed template where, of course, you have to fill in the proofs here. So it's not completely automatic. And how do we show that one set is a subset of another? Here is, again, a proof template. If you want to show A is subset B, you just say proof, and then implicitly, if you want to show a subset, the system says, ah, yeah, how do we show a subset by default? We fix an element X, we assume that X is in A, and we have to show that X is also in B. So all of this is really, I'm teaching you the language, the reasoning behind the all of these proof patterns goes back to your first undergraduate lectures, discrete structures. And now let's look at this in a demo. Here are just the proof patterns again. And this is the obtain example again. And now let's do an explicit proof. And this is what we're trying to prove. We assume that there exists an X such that for all Y, P of XY, and we want to show that then for all y there exists an x such that p of xy. This is one of these simple quantifier reasoning proofs, which first, if you haven't never seen this before, appears a bit magical. But if instead of p you read instead of p xy you read x loves y, then it becomes very easy. Then it says there exists a person x that such that x loves everybody. And here I'm saying everybody has some person that loves him. Yeah, of course, that's the simplest, that's a weaker statement. So in that way around, you can do it. You can't do it in the other way around. If you were to claim that you can permute the quantifiers in both directions, you can permute the quantifiers, but only as an implication in one direction and not in the other direction. So now, question is, how do we do this proof? And so let's put people on the spot. How would you start? Okay, proof. So what does that cause to happen if you write proof? Does that have any effect? Pardon? Yes, but also if you go back to the patterns, the proof patterns, there is one proof pattern that will kick in now automatically. Any idea? No, but then you don't have much of a choice. Which one? Pardon? The for all. Right. So this is the, let's go back to the pattern here. So you see here, these were the two patterns, one for showing universal and one for showing existential. We're not showing existential, we're showing universal, so we're in that pattern now. And if you want to reason forward from an existential, then you have to do that explicitly by an obtain. That's not something that proof will do for you. So proof QED, and then we follow the pattern. Of course, it won't like the QED now because I haven't completed the proof, but I can already write it. So we fix something, and let's not call everything X. Let's call it for a change A. Then it'll make it, it'll be clearer what goes on. Fix A, and we assume what? Sorry, no. We don't assume anything. My mistake. We have to show what? Yes. Yes. Because this is what we started from. This is what we wanted to show. And now we said proof, and that implicitly means peel off the universal quantifier. The user is giving it his own name, fix A, and then we have to show, of course, the corresponding thing inside where the Y is no longer called Y, but A. And in fact, then A is probably really a bit too confusing. Let's call it B in order to keep the X, Y, A, B correspondence. And how we do that, we don't know yet, but we can already make this into an acceptable proof by writing sorry there. That means now the system has checked the layout of the proof, everything fitted together, and, well, subproof is missing there. So now how do we refine this? Any suggestions? Well, we could do what you suggested, but what was the how would we do that? You wanted to reason forward from the existential. Yes. No. If you look back at the pattern, that can just be in the middle of a proof. Once you have if you have an existential statement, then you can take it apart. And so we do have an existential statement, namely the assumption. And you can either give that assumption a name now, for example, A, and then you could write from A, and then the obtain. So if you compare that with the pattern, here we've written then obtain, and the then was from this, and now we've write from A, because it's not this, it's something that we got out of an assumption, obtain. And now let's give this thing again a different name than X. Let's call this one A. Where what? What property does the A have? For all Y? Pardon? P of A Y, yep. So we've taken the assumption and we have taken it apart because it's existential, and we say, okay, I've chosen the name A now. And in fact, here's a little hint. Assumptions don't need to have names. You can just write ASM, and then you get... Oh, maybe it's like this? No, essence, that's it. Right. Then you get all of them, and since there is only one, that's okay. You can also write essence one in case you want to be explicit that you're referring to the first of one, but yeah. Now we have to finish this proof, but that step, so by blast. No, we still haven't been able to bridge that gap. So what do you suggest we do? Yeah?
We should replace the X in the show with A.
Yes. There are two ways of doing it, and I think one for some technical reason fails. I don't know. I think it will work actually. That's hopefully it will work. Yeah. So you want to use this pattern existential. Yeah. So we just need to say proof, and then inside we need to show the thing without the quantifier, but with some witness that you have already told me. So proof QED. And in the end, we claim we can show, which statement was it? P of
A,
B. Yep. And we don't know yet, so let's just say sorry. So everything fits together. That's fine. That proof works. And now we have to work on why can we get PAB? Where does that come from? Yeah. Yes. So let's give this a name. Let's call this P. And this is a trivial inference that you don't need to do in an explicit, you don't need to write any explicit text from it for it, but that's something that BLAST or AUTO or whatever can do automatically. So if you have a universally quantified statement, then if you replace the universal variable by any term, that is automatically a consequence. So we can write here from P show that, and then, for example, just by BLAST. So let's leave that at that, and let's go back to the slides. Yes, that was the exercise. Now, proof patterns. There's one final and quite important proof pattern for this course, namely chains of equations and inequations. And this is how you find them in textbooks. T1 equals T2, then some justification as a text, and then equals T3, again some justification, app 2 and the long sequence, and then you know that T1 is equal to Tn. You can write down something very similar in Isabel. This is how it looks like. So you start off with proving this first equation, T1 is equal to T2, followed by some proof, which may be a large subproof, I don't know. And then the remaining steps, you always write also half to indicate to the system that you are linking the next half with the previous half. And this dot, dot, dot here is really lexically identically dot, dot, dot. So you write that. That is a token in the ESA language. And what it refers to is the right-hand side of the previous line. So what you're writing implicitly here is T2 equals T3. It's just that you don't have to write the T2 again because it could be a large term. You can just write dot, 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 and the system will replace the dot, dot, dot by the T2. So when you look at the system output, it won't show you dot, dot, dot. It'll really show you the T2. And then you have a sequence of those also halves and end with the Tn, just like up here. And of course, on the right, you always have proper ESA proofs, not some textual justification. And then that's different to what you would write in a textbook. You have to, again, explicitly state what you want to get out of this, namely that T1 is equal to Tn, and then you just need a dot. That's a trivial justification because it follows trivially from what goes on before. The reason is that sometimes with these equation chains, mistakes creep in, and then people think they've proved one thing, but they've actually proved another. So that's why you need this finally proof step there. But again, it's one of those patterns you don't have to learn by heart. You just look it up when you see, oh, I want to do a proof by a chain of equations. This is the proof pattern. And Yeah, this is what I said. It's literally three dots. And you don't just have to use equality. You can also use less than or equal or less than. But it has to go in one direction only, and not. It's really for the less than or equal or the less than. You can't start with a big term and go down to a small term. You do have to start, if you have an inequality, you have to start with a small term and increase. That's just a feature of the system. So here would be another example of such a proof. And here already in the first step, you have a less than, and then you have some equalities and maybe some less than or equal. And then necessarily the last one that you show will have to be a less than. So in the first lines, you are actually performing all the proof step. In the last line, you just summarize what you've proved. And since that inequation sequence did contain a proper less than, you have to make it a less than in the end. And if you were to write down less than or equal here, then the system will just complain and say, no, 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 I can't prove this from what you've written. Yes, and this is just what I said earlier. It's just the right-hand side of the previous line. But yeah, we can skip over that. So now let's look at an example of this in the ESA language. First, here is a real example. You want to show that 0 is less or equal x squared plus y squared minus 2xy. And if you leave out the annotation that 0 is real or that any of the variables is real, then it's not clear which type you're talking about, because all of the operators involved, the 0, the less or equal, the squaring, everything is the multiplication, is available on all the numeric types, so nothing is there to fix the reals, and therefore you have to explicitly, at least in one place, state that 0 is real, and then it actually follows that everything else has to be real as well. And here's a simple example of how to prove this. So first we prove that 0 is less or equal x minus y squared. Well, that is just by simplification. So there's a built-in simplification rule that will prove such a statement, that the square of something is always greater or equal 0. And then you say also have, and now you don't have to write x minus y squared equals, but you can just write the dot, dot, dot. And if you look at the system output, which we will do in a moment, then you can actually see the system output here, the subgoal that you're trying to prove doesn't have the dot, dot, dot in, but it has filled it in with the x minus y squared. So, but note, we don't actually have to look at the output anymore. It's textually all there in the proof text. And how do we prove this, that from x minus y squared we can get to x squared plus y squared minus 2xy? Well, here we need the two tricks that I told you about earlier. One is this algebra simps that allows to multiply out algebraic terms, use distributivity. And the other one is this numeral EQ suck that converts the exponent 2 into successor of 0, and then the definition of the power operator kicks in, and it'll just convert the power into x times x, and that's how that's what you need. Sorry, that's what you need here, right? In this step here, on the right-hand side, on the left-hand side, we have x minus y squared. And in order to turn this into x minus y times x minus y, we need to add this numeral EQ suck. And then you just summarize this two-step proof and say, okay, finally, we show that 0, the thing we started out with, is less than or equal the thing we ended up with. And that is just with a dot. And now I would like to perform a similar proof with you, and you have to tell me how the proof continues. So this is what we start with. We have two real numbers, x and y. We assume that x is greater or equal to y and y is greater than 0. And we want to show that x minus y squared is less or equal to x squared minus y squared. And I have already started off the proof. This is our start term here. This is where we want to get to. And the first step that I've already written down is that x minus y squared is x squared plus y squared minus 2xy. And in fact, that was the same step that we performed earlier. So now you have to tell me how I should continue this proof. So in this show line, we are not there yet. This is where we want to get to, x squared minus y squared. This is where we have gotten to at the moment. And these are the assumptions that we can use. We haven't used them yet. So what's the intermediate step?
Also have that dot 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 is less than x squared plus y squared. Yeah, or less or equal.
Well, yes, of course. This is a bit... I think that might be too much. Why is that true? That's not enough. That's precisely the reason. So instead of going all the way, we take this one and manipulate it a little bit, as was suggested. Namely, instead of the x, which way around is it? Ah, yes, we're subtracting this term. So it's okay to replace a larger variable by a smaller one, namely the x by the y. And that is now. Oops, also, I'm sorry. So have. So we would say using the assumptions. And then it's not so clear, but maybe bisimp will do it. We can just bisimp did it. Great. Yeah. So and now I think we're ready for the final step. Now it's clear we have, here we have a y squared and minus 2 times y, so that will just hopefully automatically be converted to minus y squared. We can try by simp, and that didn't work. Now is maybe a good time to look at the output. If we now looked at the output, it actually tells you what was left over. It's in this somewhat, I find, distracting red, so I at this point usually... convert the by into an apply, and then it tells you this is the result of what's left over after the apply, and it says y squared is less or equal y times y. So there's clearly the problem. The only problem that was left was it doesn't expand the y squared into y times y. So you can either search for a rewrite rule or remember that the rewrite rule that we used earlier, this numeral EQ suck, that would help. Or because it's so simple, you can also try your luck and ask Sledgehammer, and there's a good chance that Sledgehammer will find a proof. Yeah, but it's those are complicated proofs. I did find a nice one. Yep. This one isn't too bad. So, it, for some reason, needed the commutativity of multiplication, and power 2 EQ square is pretty explanatory. It needed to expand the power of 2 into x y times y. And now we're actually, we have finished. Now we have got to the final right-hand side that we wanted to get to. If you look at the full proof, this is the right-hand side we wanted to get to. This is where we have got to. So we can just show, basically we restate what we were trying to show, and then we need the dot. Oh, what? It doesn't like it? Oh, finally, there's a finally missing. And in, that's it. So, now I want to, for the rest of the time, introduce a few more methods for streamlining proofs, making them shorter and easier to write. And the first one is pattern matching in quotations. And pattern matching is a way of abbreviating long formulas. So here is a typical example. Let's assume we want to show an if and only if between two formulas, and let's go back to the proof pattern for that. No. Here. Here's the proof pattern for showing an if and only if between two formulas P and Q. And you can see now, if you look at this text, there are three occurrences of the formula P and three occurrences of the formula Q, which means if there are big formulas, you're duplicating this, which will blow up your proof size, not the proof size, but the text size. And worse, if you ever change anything in that formula, you'll have to change it in all the other occurrences of the formula as well. So it's not very nice for proof maintenance. So what you would really like to do is you would like to introduce an abbreviation for the left-hand side and the right-hand side of that if and only if, and then use the abbreviation in the text. And that's what our pattern matching gives us. This is the start of the formula and the start of the proof, and formula 1 and formula 2 may be big chunks of text, but then you can say in parentheses, is question mark L, if and only if question mark R, and that implicitly, well, the effect of this statement is that this formula is matched against this formula, which means the L is matched against formula 1 and the R is matched against formula 2. That is, in the rest of the text, you can now use question mark L as a short form of referring to formula 1 and question mark R as a short form of the formula 2. Of course, in text, you would say something like, we assume the left-hand side, and this is our formal way of doing the same thing. And so now, if you write down the rest of the proof pattern, it really looks quite short, and it is quite short, because here, if you say assume question mark L, it really is only two characters, and the system will expand those two characters to formula 1. And if you say write show question mark R, it's again two characters, and the system will expand it to formula 2. So it's a it helps you to abbreviate what you write, and to it helps proof maintenance, because changes are propagated to all the places that use these abbreviations. There is a built-in abbreviation, question mark thesis, that is set for every show step. So here, when you write show thesis, it automatically refers to that formula in the previous show step. And that can sometimes be useful, in particular with proof steps like this, with proofs like this, where you say proof minus, which means don't do anything, that is, inside the proof block, I'm still showing that same formula. I'm not doing something like assuming the negation of the formula and proving false, but it's still that same formula because the minus didn't cause any change. And so that means here I will have to again show the same formula, and instead of writing the same formula again, I can now refer to this thesis that was set at this point. So implicitly, the system with every show, it implicitly sets the thesis like this. And in fact, we could have used that already in one of our proofs that we just did. How could we have simplified this proof text with this additional knowledge that we now have? Let's go back to the slide. Yep. Yep, that's exactly it. Sure. This is sometimes quite useful if you want to abbreviate explicitly some big formula, big term. Then you can just write the line let ?t equal then whatever text you have. And then you can later on in some statement you can refer to this ?t and the system will automatically insert this big formula, but you don't have to do it yourself. And finally, this is quite useful, namely if you want to refer to earlier proofs that you've, facts that you've proved earlier, then the standard way of doing it is giving that fact a name. So for example, have x zero, and that's the name for the fact that x is greater or equal zero, and then later on you write from x zero, blah, blah, blah. Now, X0 is nice and short, but then if there's a lot of space in between the have and the from, you have to search it where was the X0 defined. Oh, did it stand for X is greater 0 or greater or equal 0 or X is equal 0? So, of course, you could call it X is greater or equal 0, but then you write such a name for such a small formula. It's completely ridiculous. So what you can do alternatively, you can quote the value of the formula. So you don't give it a name up here, but down there, when you want to refer to it, you simply write the actual formula again. And if it's a short formula, then it's simpler to write it again rather than invent a name for it and then have to search for the name. And so that's the way this is done. And please note, these are back quotes or back ticks that enclose the reference to a previously proved formula. And the fact that I've deleted the spaces from it is of no relevance. So it's just, it has to be a previously proved formula in whatever format. And that is quite useful for short facts, like typically X is greater zero or stuff like that, that you don't want to spend time thinking about a good name for. There's no point in demonstrating this. I want to conclude the lecture with an example of a top-down proof development, again, in cooperation with you. And this is the example, and we will together figure out how to prove this lemma. What does it say? It says that, well, you might paraphrase it by saying for all x's, but you don't have to write the for all, because whenever some variable is not quantified, it's implicitly universally quantified. So this is the x's, and this claims that this x's can always be written as y's append z. So there exist two lists, y's and z's. So the append here tells us that we're talking about lists. So this starting list s can be decomposed into two lists that either have the same length or have a length that differs just by one. Makes sense. How would you prove it? Just intuitively. Not writing down in ether yet, but how would you textually explain why is that true?
Access either has an even number of elements or an odd number of elements.
Precisely. Let's stop there. So that's the main idea, and that's what the question mark should tell us. So these examples. Right. This is the lemma that we're trying to prove. Let me just move this a bit to the right, left, then we can all see it. So you want to do a proof by cases. And then there is one assume and another assume. And in between we have a next. And a QED, so this is the pattern. And in fact, and we also need in both cases a show. And what do we show? We can use theses, because if you do a proof by cases, if you go back to the pattern, what the proof by cases looks like. We are on the right-hand side. This is the kind of left-hand side. This is the proof that we want to do. We want to show something, proof by cases, assume one case, it's even, assume the other case, it's not even. And in both cases, we have to show R. That means we don't need to rewrite that R again, but we can use thesis. So proof by cases means you're still proving the same thing, but you have two cases and you can assume different things in those two cases. Thesis. Thesis. Let's put in some sorry. So we're getting more and more lines are okay. And so now the suggestion was to do a proof by case distinction on whether the length of X is odd or even. Now, since I've done that proof before, I know I have to do it in a particular way to get a short proof. And so I'm suggesting a particular case distinction. So rather than writing length is odd, I will now write this in a different way, but it'll amount to the same thing. There exists an n such that the length of x's equals n plus n. So that's just another way of saying that the length is odd, is even. And then, of course, here in the other assume, we have to write the negation, which is a tilde, right? And then we put in the formula. If you find it tedious that we have to write this formula twice, next week we will see an alternative way of writing the same thing, and then we just need to write it once. But for the time being, this is fine. And I will only look. So now the proof is in a top-down manner is okay. I've left some open subproofs, but we will now refine the first part, and the second part is analogous. Okay. So now, how does the proof continue? Again, speaking informally first. We now are in the case that X is of even length. So, yeah, tell me how you would continue. Maybe you, because you already started.
I guess I would do want to say that YS, the length of YS and the length of ZS are N.
And then the question is, how do we get to how, because we would have to give some witness for the YS and the ZS, and there are, that is something I should tell you, there are predefined functions on lists called take and drop that take the first n elements or drop the first n elements from the list. And so what would you say should be YS? Okay, so let's put that into code. So first we have to get our hand on the n, because we have used the n a number of times. How do we do that? And now, again, open for everybody. Because the n is just a locally quantified variable. We can't, if we refer to n now, the system will just say, what is n? N is a free variable. Yep. Absolutely. Then obtain n where length of x is equals n plus n. By blast. Oops. I think I should correct my spelling. Okay, so now we have the n. And now let's make use of an abbreviation mechanism. I think it may come in helpful. Yes, I think it does. Let's introduce a variable question mark y's that will be our witness for the y's, and that would just be take n of x's and let z's be, well, it was drop n of x's. And, yep, that should be it. And so now, what should we be able to prove about y's and z's? Just the statement, not the proof yet.
Well, the sum of the length is equal to the
length. Sorry, say that louder.
So, I mean, the sum of both the length of the YS and
yeah, but so what is the statement that you're trying to prove? You have to say it. But if we're done, then it should be something similar to what you're trying to prove. So what are we trying to prove? Yeah. Except, of course, we need to replace the YS with our particular terms that we introduced. Okay, let's first see if it can do that automatically. Because there's a big library about take and drop and append, and I don't want to manually go through that library, so let's just check whether this statement is amenable to a automatic proof. And so I open the sledgehammer window and type apply. And indeed, by simp. So that is already one of the, it must have been one of the lemmas. So now let's be a bit more adventurous. What else do you think should also be true? Yeah, anybody? Yep. This part of the OR, that the lengths are the same. And let's see if we can prove both of them at the same time. Typically, that's a bit ambitious, and One would probably want to prove them separately and then put them together, but let's be ambitious. So here you see this device that I told you about earlier of quoting a fact by its value, by its statement. And you don't see the back quotes because they are in the process of being superseded by these Guillemot characters, and it's just easier to type the back quotes. That's why I'm introducing the back quotes. But if you were to replace these by back quotes, that would work just as well. Right. So now how do we prove the thesis from what we have? Do we need anything else? Or no, exactly. So we should be able to then show thesis. And you can ask Sledgehammer, but you can also reason, oh, this is just pure logic with quantifiers and stuff. So that should be doable by BLAST. Yes, and it is. So because this is what you're trying to prove, and what we have in the previous line. In the previous line, we have this part of the AND, and we have this part of the OR. And if you have one part of the OR, then of course you have an OR, and therefore this is just simple deductions. And it's on the level where you wouldn't want to explain it to a mathematician in any greater detail than this. It's just obvious that that follows from that. And that's it, really. And this brings me really, yes, I think we should call it a day. Okay, I lost 5 minutes at the beginning, so let me just wrap up. Yes, so we saw an example of top-down proof development, and here is a hint what to do if the proof automation fails. Of course, the general idea is you have to prove it in smaller steps. You have to insert more intermediate steps to get to where you want to get. In order to find out what the intermediate steps might be, it still can be helpful to apply use the apply command. And how do you use this apply command in the middle of such a structured proof? This is what this slide explains. So let's assume you have some proof step, have blah, 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 using blah, 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 and automation fails to prove that step. What you do, this is how you can continue. You can say apply minus. That simply has the effect of taking all the facts that you are using in the proof and making them part of your proof state. Otherwise, it can confuse subsequent steps. And now you can just continue in your usual style of apply proofs. Typically, you might do an auto proof, and then you can see what is left over, and that will give you a hint. Oh, the system is able to deduce part of what I'm trying to prove, but not the rest. And then you can go back and refactor things. Of course, you can also go and continue in the apply style and just at the end put a done. That's not nice style. It would be better to convert all of this sequence of applies into something readable. So better is to convert this lengthy list of applies here into a structured proof. But this is the way it's done. And now, of course, at that point, when you really need to look at the output window again. Usually when you write the structured proofs, it's you write everything into the ESA text, but when you are exploring the proof with an apply style, then it's good to look at the output window again. And how does that correspond? Oh, it doesn't. Yeah. I think that's it for today. But so good luck with the tutorial where you will need what I told you. about today, and then next week we will finish the ESA language, and then the week after, so next week we'll talk about case distinctions and inductions, and next and the week after we will start the actual algorithms topic by talking about sorting algorithms. And that's it for today.